CRJ 225 or 227, I'm sorry. This is week number 5, and we are focused on search warrants. There's 5 types of activities governed by the Fourth Amendment: arrests with a warrant, arrests without a warrant, searches with warrants, and searches without a warrant, and then seizure of evidence. Police seek arrest warrants and search warrants for both arrest and searches. And when they do, there are 3 essential components. First, the warrant must be issued by a neutral and detached magistrate. In Illinois, that's a circuit or associate circuit court judge. If you're not aware of how Illinois courts are set up, there are full circuit judges that are elected for that circuit. And some of you know that Illinois has 23 circuits. Peoria area sits in the 10th circuit, Pekin's in the 10th circuit, Galesburg's in the 9th circuit, Germantown Hills, Woodford County, Metamora, Bloomington Normal, they're in the 11th circuit. So typically downstate, those circuits are made up of multiple counties. The 10th circuit, for instance, is Peoria, Tazewell, Stark, Mason, and Putnam counties. In that particular circuit, there are 22 total judges, half of which are elected by either the residents of the 5 counties or for the circuit at large. And then those elected circuit judges choose associate judges who serve on a 4-year basis. Typically, they're renewed and they are on there until they retire. When you go to the courthouse and the larger courthouses, the circuit judges are typically sitting in the big ticket item courtrooms, felony court, for instance, and the associate judges are sitting in misdemeanor and traffic court, as an example. But that's who you have to go to. In some of the smaller counties, I mentioned that the 10th Circuit's made up of Peoria and Tazewell. Those are larger counties, and they have multiple courtrooms at their courthouse and several judges at each courthouse. But then if you go to Stark, Putnam, and Mason counties, there's one judge that travels to each of those courthouses over the course of a week and hears every type of case. So in those counties, the sheriff or the police would go to that judge to seek a warrant. If you've read the materials, you know that you, as a police officer, would fill out an application for that warrant. You take it to the neutral magistrate, the detached magistrate, the circuit or associate judge. And then, second, you have to show probable cause. Our old friend, probable cause. Finally, it has to conform to the Fourth Amendment's particularity requirement. Now, we're going to focus on search warrants this week because search warrants are challenged more often than arrest warrants. So as a Peoria police officer seeking a search warrant, you have to obtain that search warrant from a neutral or detached magistrate, one of the associate or circuit judges presiding over or at the Peoria County Courthouse, and typically there's somebody assigned to perform this task amongst the judges. And in order to obtain a search warrant from the judge, 2 things must be shown. Number 1, probable cause. Showing probable cause for a search warrant is a 2-part process. First, the officer applying for the search warrant must show probable cause that the item to be seized are connected to criminal activity. And second, the officer has to show probable cause that the items to be searched for and then ultimately seized are in the location to be searched. The other element is particularity. The particularity requirement for a search warrant has 2 elements. First, the warrant must be specific as to the place to be searched. It has to specify the place to be searched. Next, the warrant must specify the items to be seized, the things that are associated with the criminality that you hope to find and seize. The reason for this particularity requirement stems from the framers of the Constitution and their concerns with so-called general warrants that were issued by the English Crown, by the King of England back in, you know, the colony stages of this country. Those warrants permitted limitless searches for evidence of treason. And then anything that was found, whether it was with probable cause or not, could lead you to big trouble. Now, it should be noted, mistakes occur as to the place to be searched. For instance, an incorrect address for the property occasionally leading to the wrong home or structure to be searched. I remember one such occasion where the structure that they went to was actually the house next door to where they were supposed to go. And you've seen the scene on TV. The door gets broken in. In this case, the door is pretty much ripped completely off the frame. And there sits a little old grandma watching The Price is Right. Fortunate that she didn't have a heart attack. And of course, her door was replaced by that municipality. But you can't have mistakes as to the items to be seized. So if there's an incorrect address or there's some sort of mistake like that, but you can't be mistaken as to the items to be seized. Now, I mentioned some cases in the materials that I provided for you, and the first was Maryland versus Garrison, a United States Supreme Court case from 1987. Where police officers obtained a warrant to search the person of Lawrence McWebb and a premises at 2036 Park Avenue, a third floor apartment. They believed that McWebb's apartment occupied the entire third floor, and in fact, there were two apartments on that floor, one of which belonged to another person named Garrison. Nevertheless, the court held that the warrant was valid because it was based on information by a trusted informant, and the police had inquired with the local utility company and were given the impression that there was only one apartment on the third floor. I don't know how how well that would fly today, but that does occur where, because of how a structure is set up, a multi-family structure like an apartment building, depending on how utilities are split up and how much access you have to do the investigation, I'm not so sure that they shouldn't have been able to figure that out. But, you know, this was in 1987. The other case I mentioned was Anderson versus Maryland, a Supreme Court case from 1976, where the court upheld a warrant that authorized the seizure of several items together with, as the court said, other fruits, instrumentalities, and evidence of crime that was known at that time. Now, the court noted that the crime in question was particularly complex and could be proved only by piecing together many bits of evidence. So, those of you that had the evidence course, CRJ 230, and those of you that will in the future, if you've had it, you know that most cases are tied together by, as that court said, piecing together many bits of evidence. In fact, that's how we prove or present most cases. Much of that evidence circumstantial, not direct. Much of that evidence less than physical. And as you'll learn in that course, or have learned, you know, everybody wants DNA and scientific exact proof, but that doesn't happen in most cases. Let's talk a little bit about executing the search warrant. There are time constraints. Service of a search warrant should take place promptly after it's issued. The probable cause that formed the basis of the search warrant could dissipate if an excessive amount of time elapses between the time of the warrant and the time that it's served. In other words, that evidence could be moved, used, changed, destroyed, could no longer exist. Second, a second time restriction that is occasionally imposed pertains to the time of day. Judges commonly restrict the service of warrants to daytime hours, or at least favor daytime service. The Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, for example, restrict the service of warrants to daytime hours unless the issuing judge specifically authorized execution at another time. Daytime hours, according to the federal rules, are between the hours of 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. So it could be after dark. Now, I have known of warrants to be served outside of those hours under extenuating circumstances, but who has discretion for that? Not the police. They can ask for it, but the judge ultimately makes that decision. The third time restriction concerns how long the police can search for evidence. The general rule is that the search cannot last indefinitely. Once the item in the warrant has been discovered, the search has to be terminated. Let's talk a little bit about the scope and manner of the search, the scope and manner. Scope appears to where the police can look for evidence. Manner refers to the physical steps the police can take to find the evidence in question, including breaking down doors, forcibly opening locked cabinets, and other actions that could potentially damage property. I cited in the materials the Harris versus United States Supreme Court case from 1947 that provided clarification. Language from that case: the same meticulous investigation which would be appropriate in a search for two small canceled checks could not be considered reasonable where agents are seeking a stolen automobile or an illegal still. In other words, the size of the item sought, the circumstances of the place searched, the likelihood that that item is there. If you're looking for smaller items, you're going to look in places where smaller items could be. If you're looking for larger items, you're not going to look in places where smaller items would be. The other case cited, Michigan versus Summers, a 1981 Supreme Court case. The language from that case: a warrant to search for contraband founded on probable cause implicitly carries with it limited authority to detain the occupants of the premises while the proper search is conducted. What that goes to is law enforcement's interest at stake in preventing flight. And so when the search is conducted, anybody who is present or on premises at that time can be detained until after the search is completed. And if there's any criminal activity or anything that needs to be charged, it can be charged. And if not, that those individuals can be free to go. Police typically have to complete some type of a search record to be kept on file with the department. Interestingly, the police are not required to notify the property owner of the steps necessary for the return of the property or to remedy any perceived constitutional violation, and that's from the Covina, City of West Covina versus Perkins case I cited from 1999. Now, as a practical matter, on this particular issue about completing some type of a search record, the procedure and practice in these cases is going to be that things are going to be documented by a video record. And for some departments, even before body cams, part of the search, once you got the the premises secure and the individuals in the premises secure, and the actual search was underway, it was advised to that, and most departments would video that search. So you would have a video record of what was searched and where things were found, etc. So as we've discussed a few times now over the summer, video can be a positive thing. You don't have to worry about creating a record. Now, will you still write a report based on what you find and what you do? Essentially, should confirm that video? Yes. But in all likelihood, and please make sure you do, have a video record. Let's talk about challenges for a minute. Search warrants are challenged far more often than arrest warrants, as I said earlier, primarily because of the potential of shortcomings in the affidavit with probable cause. This is essentially true with narcotics search warrants, as the evidence is often easy to move or dispose of. Plus, the information that you're getting as to where the contraband is and who possesses it and that it's at that location may come from a confidential informant who may or may not be that reliable. As a result, search warrants are rejected and the evidence obtained thrown out for a variety of reasons limited solely to the imagination and gumption of a defense attorney. The effort and diligence of a police officer who sought the search warrant and the carefulness of the judge who reviewed the application for the search warrant is going to make or break that search warrant and its application and usefulness. Examples you'll see in the cases that you find for this week: failure to be specific as to the time frame narcotics were on the premises sought to be searched, failure to connect the evidence to the property to be searched, an affidavit that's riddled with conjecture or generalization. Conjecture or generalization, I gave the example. Habitual users of drugs keep drugs and paraphernalia in their home. Well, duh. So how do you know that there's habitual, who are the habitual users, and what's your evidence that habitual users are keeping drugs or paraphernalia in this home? Specifics, not generalizations. Or too much reliance on opinions based on an officer's training and experience. It's not enough to just say, based on my training and experience. You can say, based on my training and experience, and you can list out what that training and experience is, but you have to have facts specific to this circumstance, the people, the place, and the criminality, the acts that are alleged to be subject of the search warrant. In other words, tell the judge what you know, not what you feel, in seeking a search warrant. Comes back to that same old theme. Don't tell me how you feel, tell me what you know. I'm going to briefly talk about electronic surveillance. And electronic surveillance includes a variety of methods of spying on the activities of suspected criminals, including both conversations and suspected criminal actions. The methods used are pretty diverse and include wiretapping, bugging a phone, hacking into computer transmissions, tracking movements of persons and equipment, video surveillance, seeing through opaque surfaces, using devices such as thermal imaging, gun detectors, ShotSpotter, and Peoria. If you plan to use information from any of these things, except the ShotSpotter, I guess, you better first seek a warrant to make sure that you comply with this type of search. So if you're going to, bug a person's phone or monitor their transmissions, you should have a search warrant that allows you to do that. And then from that search warrant, that'll say, for instance, a specific set of numbers, a specific time frame, etc. Can't just be, wide open. The reason for ShotSpotter, if you're not familiar with that, and I'm sure you've heard of ShotSpotter, is different. It surveys and takes information from outside structures and pinpoints the location of gun use in a certain section of the city. And it may lead to evidence, but it's not invasive in doing so. And in fact, a lot of times it could be wrong. For instance, in the summer, when firework use becomes rampant, depending on calibration, it could very well pick up things that are not gunfire. But it doesn't lead you to an individual. It doesn't. It just tells you that there was some sort of gun activity within that particular location of the spotter, which is essentially a microphone that picks up those sounds. So that's our focus on search warrants for this week. We have one more week that relates to the 230 course to an extent. And then we have another week of material before wrapping up the course. Things are going to slide downhill very quickly. So, as I've said in the past, keep your energy up. Keep your focus up. Find a way to get into the course, to do your work. Don't wait till the last minute. Log back in and read what other people have posted. And now that we're doing cases, you're going to see different examples. Hopefully you did a good job of finding a relevant case to what was sought and a relevant job or a good job of summarizing that case, and other students did too, and you can learn a lot from those various examples because, as I state over and over, it's the facts and the issue of all those circumstances and the application of whatever it is we're talking about at the time that you're going to be able to draw on when you go out there and deal with a different circumstance. And while you may deal with the same application of the same criminal code or the same criminal procedure expectations in a given situation, the facts, the issues, the circumstances are probably always going to be slightly different. And you're going to have to be able to think on your feet and apply the law. That's the podcast for week number 5. If you need me, you know where to find me.